Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Go Wild is a free social community created for and by hunters. Go Wild has recently partnered with Mountain Tough for a free 30-day workout program designed to get you in shape for turkey season called the Go Wild Challenge. Download Go Wild to sign up and let everyone know in a Go Wild post that you're joining us. Then, each time you do a workout, tag Go Wild and Mountain Tough to hold yourself accountable. Also, Go Wild will be attending the Great American Outdoor Show February 4th through the 12th. If you're in the area, stop by booth 412, meet the guys, and learn all about Go Wild. Visit downloadgowild.com and sign up today.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. And joining me on the show today is Will Boyle. Now, Will is a guy who has hunted vastly different areas in the past few years, from Texas and Louisiana all the way up to Pennsylvania, and he had to learn some new techniques and strategies. Growing up in Pennsylvania, high pressure, big woods, it's totally different than hunting the heat in the South, and different rutting times, different topography, different forest density and foliage cover. And so I'm really excited to hear from him what it is that he implemented to help him be successful in both places, and how he is going about and pursuing chasing after whitetails now that he's back home in his home state of Pennsylvania. So let's jump into this episode with Will.
Like, he was doing things that were just badass.
That was one of the coolest moments of my life.
I was really scared, but knowing that Dan had the gun, I did have the rifle, like, we would be okay.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. And joining me on the show today, I've got Will Boyle. Now, Will is a serviceman from Pennsylvania originally, spent some time in the South, and I'm excited to hear what switching states and switching hunting strategy and style kind of paid off for him, because hunting Pennsylvania versus Louisiana has to be a pretty big shift. So Will, thanks for hopping on with me, man.
Hey, thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
For those that don't know who you are, why don't you share with them a little bit about yourself, maybe your history, what you do, or how you got into hunting?
All right. Well, I guess where we'll start is what I do for a living. I'm a fireman by trade. I've been a fireman for as long as I can remember, even before I was allowed to be. I was exposed to it at a very, very young age, and was brought up in a firehouse. Started as a volunteer whenever I was 16. Like Dan mentioned there, I was born and raised in central Pennsylvania, a little known city of Dubois, and from there I left there my high school, end of my high school year, to go to the military. I enlisted in the Air Force and did a 5-year stint there as a fireman. And then, realized that wasn't something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I realized that, you know, though the Air Force affords a good quality of life for its people, it was not a life that I wanted to keep pursuing. So I was looking at my options, and, you know, had a couple close friends that were civilians for the government, but, you know, we're still firemen. And so I started applying to different places, military installations that had their own fire department. And as it turned out, out of 18 different places I applied to, the one I got was an hour from where I grew up. So I'm back in Pennsylvania. I work for the VA Butler healthcare system as a firefighter. We have our own fire department. And I absolutely love what I do. The three things that make me tick are my family, firefighting, and hunting. And those are in no particular order. but it's, like I said, it's what I do. I love doing it. And when I'm not at the fire station at work, I'm either in the woods or at least with family. So That's what makes me tick.
Man, that's awesome. So going into the military, did you intend on going in as a firefighter, or did you find out like, hey, I can pursue this also?
Well, it became an option. I wanted to do the firefighting thing as a paid career firefighter. And in my area, there isn't a lot of avenues for that. I mean, sure, we have Pittsburgh and we have, Philadelphia way out east, but there was only small towns that would have very, very, very small fire departments. And I quickly realized that it would be very hard for me to try to get into one of those departments. There's always a selection process, and, not to cry about it, but, a lot of people know they don't pay guys enough money to go running into burning buildings, especially on the civilian side. And so I realized that I had an option of going to the military and trying to be a fireman. And of course the Air Force was the best bet for that. They have the biggest fire protection branch of their organization. And I started doing a little bit more research, and I ended up going to the recruiter's office and basically told him, look, it's a firefighting contract or nothing. And he says, well, we don't do it that way. That's not how this goes. You go through the medical process, you get cleared, and then we put your contract out for bid, essentially. It's almost like a draft, the way the recruiters do it. You make up a list of jobs you want, and they try to get you the highest one on your list. And I said, look, I said, it's either going to be a firefighting contract or I'm walking out the door. And he made it happen. I told him, I said, I'm not signing anything until it says firefighter on my contract. And he made it happen. And so I graduated in June of 2016, and September of 2016, I left Dubois, and that was the first real big, out of state. I mean, I'd been on vacation in multiple states, but I'd never really been away from home per se.
Yeah.
And I went all the way down to Texas, did basic training in tech school, and spent the first hunting season away from home in San Angelo, Texas, out in Goodfellow Air Force Base, way out in West Texas. And it was funny because, my dad and brother sending me trail camera pictures, and, they were hunting, and I'm looking at all the tame deer on the base that are walking down the sidewalks and everything between the dormitories, and there wasn't a thing I could do about it. But no, and like I said, it was a good stepping stone for me. It gave me a lot of the certifications I have today, taught me how to be a career firefighter, and made the transition over to civilian life that much easier. I mean, I do the same job today that I do in the air that I did in the Air Force, minus the aircraft. We don't have any airplanes down here in Butler, but I do the same job. I just wear a different uniform. Most of our guys are ex-military, and we still get to serve as a part of the government, with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and so I still have that connection with the military and with veterans on a daily basis. And I, again, one of those things, I love what I do, and I don't think it'll ever change.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. I feel like once you find that thing that like makes you tick, or that you feel like, hey, this is my purpose, it makes everything so much easier and more enjoyable. And the fact that you've been able to transfer that from, in high school to post high school military to now a career outside of the military, that's pretty awesome. I'm sure when I had to kind of laugh when you were talking about getting trail camera pictures and being away.
It sucks.
yeah, that, I mean, because I moved away from my home state of Wisconsin, kind of a similar deal. My brother's calling me like, oh dude, we got some big bucks on camera. And I think at that point he had like a flip phone. There was no way he could even send me a picture. I don't even know if you could transfer a picture from your trail camera to a cell phone at that point. And he would tell me about all these deer, and I'm down here in Missouri, and I'm like, man, I just want to be up there. I want to be hunting. Then the same thing after living in Missouri for years, moving out to Colorado, all my buddies are like, hey, they'd keep me in the group text, I think, to torture me. Like, hey guys, tomorrow's opening day. Who's coming out? And I'm just like, I hate all of you. I want to be back there. But what was that like? Going from from being in high school, hunting a property that you were familiar with, to being down in Texas and then Louisiana and like really trying to figure everything out brand new?
I mean, you said it right there. It was an adjustment. You know, I went from hunting the same family property, you know, and a couple parcels of public land, but most of our deer hunting was done on our small 50-acre family property. I started hunting it with my family whenever I was about 10. I started actually deer hunting there. I guess it was 2008. I killed my first buck on the last day of gun season, and I didn't miss, you know, any weekends or any opening days, you know, in that entire time, from the time I was 10 to the time I was 18. It's, you know, I love doing it. I love that property. And, you know, being away from it, I knew it was going to be a sacrifice that had to be made that year specifically. But I kind of had an open mind, if you will. That's not really the term I'm reaching for. I guess I was just hoping that where I ended up getting stationed after tech school, because it's unknown, you know, you get yeah. done with tech school and they kind of just cut you orders like, here, this is where you're going. And, you know, I had hopes, you know, somewhere that I could do some good hunting, you know, and, you know, maybe out west, maybe, you know, and, you know, somewhere in the Northeast, you know, that I'm more familiar with, you know, what have you. And it was funny because I'm sitting there and, you know, I missed out that entire season of hunting. I didn't get any turkey hunting. I didn't get any deer hunting. And it wasn't until I got done with tech school that I got home. It was still late season muzzleloader, and I got to do a wee little bit of hunting, and I killed a doe the first day we hunted with the flintlock, and 2 days later killed a doe with a bow, and I was only up there for a short week, so yeah. That was what I was, you know, able to get done while I was there. And, you know, it kind of filled the void. But when I got those orders, it said Barksdale, and I'm like, where the heck is Barksdale? So I had to Google it. It says, you know, Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. I said, Louisiana, are you kidding me? Like, what? I don't know anything about the Deep South at all, other than it's hot, you know. And I'm thinking, like, and swamps and everything. All you know, I think Louisiana, all I could think of is swamp people and Duck Dynasty, and, you know, that, because that's all I was exposed to, you know. You know, up north. And so I didn't know how it was going to go. And I got down to Barksdale and, started talking with, you know, the people at the base, and, you know, everybody does a pretty good job of welcoming you. It's just kind of a military type, culture, if you will, you know. Hey, you know, what makes you tick? You know, what do you enjoy doing? You know, do you like to go out to clubs and friends? You like to ride dirt bikes? Do you like to video game? Not really. not up my alley, you know. And I kept telling people, I'm like, look, I fight fire and I hunt. That's all I do. Yeah. And they're like, oh man, you're gonna love it here. And I'm like, what? No way. Like, we're in Louisiana. What am I gonna do? Hunt alligators? And they said, I said, no, seriously. They're like, this base is huge. And this is all within the first couple of weeks of being there. And you're kind of confined to the dormitory. You go from the dormitory to the fire station and back. And at the time, I didn't even have a vehicle. I hadn't bought a vehicle yet. So I was getting rides from other airmen. And, you know, it was a real adjustment period. And they're like, yeah, seriously, man, this place is huge. You know, and Barksdale Air Force Base is like 22,000 acres.
Oh,
and I believe like only a little over 2,000 of it is inhabited by like the facilities and the airstrip and everything else. So you're talking almost 20,000 acres of woods. They call it the East Reservation. And I didn't find this out until, you know, I got down there in April. It was, you know, probably June, July, and it's too hot to go do anything, you know. But you know, I think it might have been like the first week of June or whatever. I found a truck I liked. I bought it. And that's when the exploring started happening. I linked up with some of the guys. They have a natural resource office there. They have guys that are actually paid to manage that reservation and the wildlife and everything. I, you know, I started picking their brains. I'm like, hey, look, if I'm going to do it down here, if I'm going to make it, you know, quality of life wise, like I have to find some hunting. And they're like, oh yeah, no problem. And they handed me some maps and, you know, a gate card to go out to the reservation. I'm like, what's this for? They're like, oh, you go out past the Jurassic Gate. I said, what's the Jurassic Gate? They said, believe me, you'll know it when you get to it. Just go down this road and you'll hit it. And that's when you're on the reservation. And I figured out why they called it the Jurassic Gate is because it looked like a park out or a gate out of Jurassic Park. I mean, you pulled up to this thing, this big metal gate, and you know, you scan the car and it just kind of opens. You can hear the Jurassic Park theme song playing in the background, and you know, you go out into this, you know, giant, you know, reservation they have. But I didn't know where to start. I had no idea how to hunt southern deer. And you know, I always knew that hunting, you know, a buck is different. It's a different animal than hunting just deer.
Yeah.
You know, hunting a mature buck, that is. And I come to find out that hunting a mature southern deer is substantially different than hunting, you know, any kind of deer, period. And so, like I said, I started poking around, learned what I could from talking with people. And again, with hunting that managed property of mine, I knew where to sit. I knew what stands to sit in, what the deer usually did. I had, you know, thousands of acres that to me was unexplored. I mean, plenty of people had their deer stands there. There's plenty of trails. Lots of people hunt it. I mean, they get a little over 100 hunters a day, you know, on the managed hunts and things like that.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, but to me, it was almost unspoiled wilderness. Like, I had no idea. It was like starting from scratch, blank piece of paper. And so I started slowly figuring it out. And I started hunting it in 2017. And it would have been the fall of 2017. Started bow hunting. And I bought a couple trail cameras. Now, mind you, I'm also now getting paid big boy money, you know, if you will. I had a part-time job in high school, but I never, there's enough to put gas in my vehicle, but never really had, you know, money to start throwing at hunt stuff. So when I started getting paid big boy money with minimal bills and expenses, I started spending money on hunting stuff, you know, some trail cameras and got a new bow and everything else. And I had a little bit of success finding deer, but all the pictures were at night. I couldn't figure out really why. Find a place that in my mind looked pretty, you know, or looked like something I may hunt in Pennsylvania. It's entirely different for hunting down there, you know, and, but nevertheless, you know, and during one of the gun hunts, it would have been the last week of November, because their rut's a little bit different. I imagine you see it a little bit down your way too, but like Pennsylvania, that first week of November is magic.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of, Halloween for me is the day that I really start honing in. But that first week in November is it. Well, I started hunting hard the first week of November down there, still hunting in a t-shirt because it's 80-some degrees. And wondering why I'm not seeing a whole lot in the way of deer. And the guys are like, don't worry, like, rut hasn't even come in yet. I'm like, okay. So I come to find out that, like, last week of November, first week of December is magic.
Okay.
And they have it coincide with their rifle hunts. You know, Louisiana seasons are completely different than the way they ran it on the base. The base has to have managed hunts, because obviously you can't just have a bunch of guys running around with high-powered rifles on a military installation.
Yep.
So they had managed hunts. You had to check in at the resource office, go to your stand. You had to be in your stand during quiet hours. You couldn't get down. There was no walking around or anything like that. And you had to leave your stand and come back in, check in. Obviously, if you killed anything, you had to check in. It was all really well managed. And so during one of the gun hunts, it was either November 30th or December 1st, you know, looked down the creek bottom. And it was one of the very few deer that I'd even seen on the hoof that season during daylight hours. And I caught a glimpse of it, saw it had a rack, and saw that it was more than likely big enough for their antler restrictions.
Okay.
And shot it, and turned out it was nice 8 point. It was my biggest buck to date, you know, and was tickled pink. But then at that point is when I started trying to figure things out and look at things a little differently. Because again, you know, I got lucky on that. I had a ladder stand that was along this open strip of woods and, you know, surrounded by the loblolly pine trees. And I got lucky and saw him sneaking down through the thick creek bottom. And I started to realize that, you know, if I was going to have that kind of success, I needed to replicate it year after year. And so I started looking at it more towards, why was this buck here? Not, hey, cool, he was here, I got him, but yeah, why was he here? And I, you know, I started piecing it together. You know, okay, well, this is the rut down here. He was in the thickest cover in the area. There's, you know, even thicker pockets. He was moving bedding to bedding is what it turned out to be, you know, and he was in a travel cord. And I started to realize what I thought was thick enough wasn't. And I started looking at things a little bit differently. And then that off season, I bought a heck of a lot more cameras and spent a heck of a lot more time driving around. And most of that being during, like, you know, because their season goes to February. So like the early part of March, I really started looking around out there because it was cooler. The foliage still hadn't completely, you know, come on the trees yet. And, you know, you hadn't had that massive green up that you get down south. And I started doing a little bit of postseason scouting. Didn't know what to call it. Just knew I was doing the scouting, looking for signs. Yeah. You know, as it turns out, the popular term is postseason scouting. And I still do it to this day. That's my favorite way to scout. And started figuring out more and more. And from there, I ended up, I took leave like a moron. I took leave during that first week of December because that's when our gun season is up here.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hunt with the family. I took leave, came up here, and I still shot a little basket rack 8-point, you know, but for only being up here for a week and a half, that was good enough for me. So I didn't kill a buck down there the second year. But yeah, that's almost trivial. And then I started figuring more out. The hunting public kind of came into view for me. I started watching YouTube in my free time at the stations and stuff. And again, with our schedule at the time, we were working 24 on, 24 off. So every other day you're off. And then we ended up switching to a 48-48. So that meant, you know, you're at the station for 2 days, but then you're off for 2 days.
Yeah.
And if you had we call it a Kelly day, it's like a break day where your shift's working, but you're off, and every person has a different day. That's their Kelly day. So you'd end up having like 3-day weekends and things like that. That's great for a hunter.
Yeah, for real.
You know, you can, well, as long as the cold front, you know, happens to fall at that time, you know, and the cycle when you're off, it kind of sucks sitting at the station when a cold front's in and you're getting on your trail camera pictures and you can't do a thing about it. But, so I started learning some stuff from them and, you know, kind of dove deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole. And, in 2018, I put up, no, I'm sorry. 2018 was the year I took off and went up there. So it would have been 2019. I put in a couple micro food plots in the thickest, nastiest cover I could find. I got a clearing permit from the resource office. And by hand, because I had nothing down there, you know, I went out there with hand tools and you know, hand spreaders and everything else, and put in a couple micro food plots.
So you can apply for a permit to do that on the base.
Yes, yeah, that's and awesome. I don't know if they do them anymore. I think towards the end of my time down there, they were getting away from doing that because guys were paying guys to come in with skid loaders and things like that.
Oh, dang.
To yeah. And so they got away from that. But like I went in because, you know, there was a couple places like for a rifle stand that I wanted to clear a couple small shooting lanes. And they're like, oh, yeah, you just need a clearing permit. And they ran me down through the whole process. And the way it works down there is, I guess I should have prefaced it with this, that you have like spots, essentially. They make it out to be like a, you know, 200 yard by 200 yard square. That's kind of your spot, you okay. know, and anybody can hunt it if you're not there, but you know, you put in for a lottery and you get to pick different spots on the reservation that, you know, is your spot. And you go in, you can put your tree stand up, you can, you know, tag a tree. Again, at that point, I'm still hunting out of hang on stands and everything else. So I'm going in the heat of August you know, based on trail camera intel and things like that, and hanging, you know, walk on stands, yeah, you know, in trees that, you know, are, you know, I think are decent areas. And they said that that year, 2019, I tried to put in a couple micro food plots, and it did great for getting pictures of deer at night, but I didn't have a whole lot of daytime action. And it was either in 2018 or 2019, I was getting pictures of some really decent bucks. I'm not real good at judging them on the hoof, but I would safely say that a few of them were pushing 150. Nice. And they do have some big deer down there. And on the reservation, I can't say anything for, you know, that part of the state of Louisiana, you know, as far as the public land goes, but the base has some really big deer. And, you know, I was just trying to figure it out. I realized I was getting close, you know, I started getting more consistent pictures. I realized I was getting close to the bedding, but I wasn't quite there yet. And I had a blind that was up on a platform, if you will, and it was overlooking some of these strips that I had made and planted. And my goal was to have a couple deer come out and feed right before dark and be able to, you know, be able to kill my deer that way. And hunting really hard, and it would have been December 2nd, so that magical time, right at dark, I look over and up out of this thick bowl comes a buck, and I could just tell he was a nice buck. So I stopped him, and he was in some pretty thick cover, thick enough that I probably shouldn't have taken the shot, hindsight, but I could make out about where his shoulder was, and I squeezed off, and he takes off, goes running back down into the bowl, and I go over, there's no blood or hair, and I got to the edge of the bowl thinking, well, maybe, you know, he went down here, and sure enough, he was laying at the bottom of it. And the funny story with that one is, he ended up coming in at about 200 pounds. And the guys at the resource office, when you check in a deer, they weigh it, they age it, and they age the deer at 5.5, which for me was unheard of. We don't get deer that old here in Pennsylvania. Not with the pressure we have. So it's pretty rare that you get a deer 3.5, 4.5. I mean, it happens, but not typically. So I was over the moon. And the problem was that deer was at the bottom of this bowl, and the reservation back in, you know, I think it was World War One. You know, somebody's going to comment, no, you're wrong after doing the research, but I believe it was World War One was a bombing range for, you know, for army, you know, pilots at the time. And so, you know, looking on Onyx and everything, I'm like, oh, look, there's all these cool terrain features. No, those are craters. in the ground. I mean, they're just, you know, deep bowls the size of, you know, like my living room that are, you know, 30, 40 feet almost straight down. And of course he's laying down the bottom of it. It's thick as all get out on either side. Sorry, my dog's making a whole lot of noise. Anyway, I called one of my buddies and I'm like, hey, you know, I got one. Can you come help? Oh no, man, I'm sorry. I'm coming back to Dallas. I won't be there for another hour. Called my other buddy. Oh man, I'm on a movie date with a girl. I can't help you either. Well, I'm on my own for this one. So I ended up, I was trying to do that. I had him by the rack and I was trying to go tree to tree, you know, slowly pulling my way up the hill and wasn't getting very well. And, you know, getting up there in any kind of a speed doing that, and I was slipping most of the time. So I thought, well, you know, what else can I do? And what it ended up turning into is I would squat down, use my legs, grab the deer by the rack, you know, basically squat lift him straight up to my chest and just fall back, you know, the deer on top of me, you're in trying to incline up this hill, you know? And so by the time I got him up to the top, I was absolutely spent. All the lactic acid had built up in my legs and, you know, I dry heaved a whole bunch of times, but now I've got to walk 300 yards back to the truck to grab the deer cart, which fortunately the year before, you know, my lovely wife, girlfriend at the time, you know, had bought me, and then wheel him back out through the mud and everything else. And of course it's a heavier deer, so the tires are sinking down in the mud. And so, like I said, by the time I got back to the truck, I was totally spent, but he was a, you know, just a nice heavy short tined 8 point, you know, and the fact that he was a mature deer is what, you know, got me excited. Yeah. It made me think, you know, okay, I might be starting to figure some things out. And naturally I wanted more, you know, I wanted to start figuring things out even more. And so down the rabbit hole, even further I went. That was about the time that everybody started talking about hunting saddles. And I'm like, what is this nonsense? And, but I did like the mobile aspect of things. You know, these guys, like the hunting public, they carry their sticks in on, you know, on their backs, you know, with stand, they go in, they find a tree they like, they'd hang it. And during bow season, you could do that on the base. You know, most 3/4 of the hunters that would hunt the base were only hunting during the gun hunts. You know, there was only a handful of bow hunters. So I looked at it as free range, just about anywhere I wanted to go. You know, it wasn't a spot I had to register. If I knew that there were deer in there, or I knew it was a good early season spot, I could go in there and bow hunt. So I liked the mobile aspect of things. And I started trying to work on that setup. You know, I got it was a Millennium M100 or something like that. It was a real nice seat. It was fairly lightweight stand. And kind of laughed that it, you know, I thought that was lightweight. And a set of sticks, and I'd strap it on, and I'd go clinking through the woods back to certain spots, and, you know, get all sweatied up going up a tree in October when it's still 90 degrees down there, and think, oh yeah, this is hunting. I'm doing it like the guys on the hunting public, woohoo, you know. Never see a deer. And I'm like, okay, something's going on here. Well, then I decided I'd try the saddle thing out, you know, and again, this entire time, I'm scouting harder than I ever have. I'm running more cameras than I ever have. And now that I have a couple of years of history down here on this base, I'm like, you know, I'm starting to figure out certain areas are real hot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm diving into thick bedding. I'm finding sheds, you know, right there in, you know, the early part of March. And that's, like I said, I figured, well, I may want to try this saddle thing. But I didn't want to spend the money on it. You know, I was looking at how much most of this was. I'm looking at Tethered's website. I'm going, no way. You know, I'm not spending this kind of money for a, you know, maybe like it or maybe don't like it.
Yep.
And so I started DIYing a lot of stuff. Not really a manly man type of thing, but I'm fairly decent behind a sewing machine. You know, and so I started looking at saddles and going, I can make that. You know, and I'd buy components off Amazon and, you know, piece them together. And I DIY'd my own saddle from scratch, essentially.
Dang.
And it was not comfortable by any stretch of the imagination. Now, I did buy a Tether Predator platform right from their website. I spent the money on that. And, you know, realized pretty early on that I thoroughly enjoyed it, that it was really the way to go. And so I kept honing that setup, and eventually after about, I think I hunted with my DIY saddle maybe through like October of that year going into the 2020 season. And so I was like, well, you know, I like it. You know, there's no question that I like it, and I think it's the way to go. I might as well spend the money on it. So I bought a Tethered saddle, and you know, of course, then started to refine my setup even more. I got the Hawk climbing sticks, the, you know, the three-step ones back when those were still readily available, and, you know, painted them up and everything. And that's when I realized, oh, this is what lightweight is like, you know.
Yeah.
And really being able to dive, you know, into thick cover. I still had a couple trees that I would preset, you know, with the big steel clanky climbing sticks that I knew were in good spots. One of them was in the same place that I'd shot that big heavy 8 point, and which wasn't far from the place I'd shot the first year down there in my first year. And I had just about figured that place out, you know, as far as where they were going, how they were coming through there, how they were using it. And my birthday that year, Summer had gotten me a Moultrie mobile trail camera. And so I was running it down in that bottom, and I was getting pictures of deer, and I was getting pictures of nice bucks during daylight hours. And I'm like, yep, I've got it pretty well figured out. And it just so happened that one of the best cold fronts came on during a gun hunt. And I went out there. I actually took my inline, my CVA inline, because it was a synthetic stock, and I didn't want to ding up my good rifle trying to, you know, climb and, you know, do a hanging hunt. And I knew I was doing well as far as access goes and as far as lightweight and quiet goes when I got up the tree, set the platform, was hanging, and as it started to get daylight, I thought I saw a movement down in the thick stuff below me, and I look and there's a doe bedded only about 40 yards below me. Dang. And she never knew I was there. Once it got daylight, she stood up and started milling around, you know, down the little bowl. And I'm like, well, okay, this is pretty good, you know. At least as far as efficient and quiet goes, I'm getting better. And it was probably, you know, mid morning, you know, and I looked over and I see something black moving through the trees. Now, I had shot hogs down there. They have quite a few hogs on the base. And I thought maybe it was a hog at first. And I look even, you know, finally get a glimpse of it through the trees, and it's a jet black coyote.
Dang.
And I've had pictures of plenty of coyotes and a couple of black ones on the camera, but I'm like, I've got my in line. He's, you know, 300 yards to the woods. You know, what am I going to do? And he actually ended up going out of sight. I was like, well, there, that's that. It was kind of cool to see him, but, you know, probably 15 to 20 minutes later, I look down and he's actually coming back up through the creek bottom below me. Of course, there's smoke everywhere. And after a little while, I got down and went down to check, and, you know, sure enough, 50 yards from where I shot him, there he laid. And so that was a $800 taxidermist bill,
yeah.
Big, you know, like 35-pound male, you know, jet black with a big white patch on his chest. That was absolutely out of this world.
That's cool.
2 days later, I'm sitting in the same tree, and not long after daylight, I see a buck coming through the woods, and, you know, looked to be a good enough buck. And you know, I actually had the rifle with me that day because I figured I could do it without dinging it up. And so I shot him with the rifle and didn't realize it until I got down to him. And it was actually this buck here behind me, over my left shoulder there. Didn't realize till I got down to him, but it was my biggest buck to date. Which was even funnier because I took the first week of November and went home on leave that year. So that would have been, again, like the December 1st time frame that I killed this buck here. But the first week of November, I was at home and killed a decent buck with my bow in Pennsylvania, which at that point was the biggest buck. And then a week, you know, biggest buck I'd taken. And then a week later, I outdo it again, shoot an even bigger buck.
What a year.
So it was a very good year. But yeah, in 2018, they did an alligator hunt, and I put in for it, got drawn for a tag. That, you know, they only did like 10 tags for the entire base, and was fortunate enough to draw a tag. Got a 8.5 foot alligator out of one of the lakes out there. So Louisiana just it gave me a lot of out of this world hunting opportunities that I never thought as a Pennsylvania boy I'd ever get.
Yeah.
And you know, I learned a lot from, you know, my dad and my grandpa, you know, and other guys that I've hunted with over the years, and you know got fundamentals from all of them. But it wasn't until I got down there and started to have to figure things out for myself that I really started putting pieces of the puzzle together. And, you know, like I said, that's where we kind of lead into, you know, with this year and starting to, you know, apply it at home, you know, and that's, you know, I can't say enough about the things that I learned down there and being able to apply them now and how much it's helped. You know, it gave me a whole different way of looking at things. I thought whenever I I started bow hunting whenever I was 16. You can start hunting on your own, you know, in Pennsylvania when you're 16. I got a secondhand bow from a guy and did not know at all whatever I was doing. You know, I put up a couple of hang on stands on the property, had a couple encounters with deer. I didn't know what I was doing and never found any success during bow season. Always seemed to kill one during the gun season, you know, a little scrub buck or something. You know, from the time I was 10 to the time I was 16, I killed a buck every year, you know, a little, nice. Little scrubby 6 point, 7 point, whatever, you know, whatever it was. And, you know, I thought then, you know, oh, well, I'm diehard and I'm figuring things out. You know, I didn't know a thing. and there are days I still don't think I know anything as far as what I'm doing.
All right, guys, if you've been listening to the podcast, I'm sure you've heard me talk about the helicopter hog hunt that I did down in Texas. Now, I went down there with Rogue Texan Outfitters, and Landon and Brandon, the owners, put us on the animals. We killed 150 pigs and 19 coyotes just from the air. On top of that, we went out thermal hunting at night and got up close and personal two more hogs. I didn't have to worry about bringing guns or ammunition because all of that was provided for me, and it is to this day the most action-packed day of hunting I've ever had. I stand by what I've said in the past, and that's that helicopter hog hunting is the funnest thing that you can do with pants on. In addition, they offer sandhill crane hunts and predator calling. So if you're looking for the most exciting hunt of your life and something that you're going to want to come back and do year after year, go check out RogueTexan.com and book your hunt today. So, like, when you went back up, though, from Louisiana, I mean, what were the types of things that you said, hey, I'm going to change? Because I totally understand the northern hunting deal. Like, I bet you we didn't even move tree stands for 10 years. Like, you just sit in the same tree every year. Like, oh, that's dad's tree. That's my tree. That's your tree.
Yep.
What type of things did you start implementing right when you came back?
So we moved back in later part of August of 2021. And, you know, that's rolling straight into preseason prep. And there were things I knew I wanted to do a little bit differently. You know, I wanted to move a couple bow stands. Of course, I wanted to set up some trees to saddle hunt. At the time, my brother didn't saddle hunt, so we had to set trees that were for him, you know, and trees that were for me, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, I looked at the property entirely different. I still had the preconceived notions, which sometimes were detrimental, of, you know, well, the deer always do this, or they always seem to do that. And that didn't help me quite as much as I had hoped. But, you know, I was looking at things a little bit differently, paying more attention to the real thick cover, and that's probably where they're bedding, not so much, oh, the deer are always in the pond.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe, you know, but this is where they're really hanging. This is really where their core area is. And at that point, I had bought a couple more cellular cell cameras and deployed those. And going into the 2021 season, you know, I had good hopes for archery. Again, you know, I kind of reverted a little bit into my old habits of knowing, okay, well, this is historically a good spot. And it paid off, you know. On our property, if you're in any of the really good stands that are in decent travel corridors and you spend enough time in one of those stands during that first week of November, you're going to have a shooter buck walk within range.
Yeah.
You know, plain and simple. And I did, and was able to get that buck, and I was happy with it. You know, I was, you know, back in Pennsylvania, back on my home turf, shot a nice buck with my bow. I was happy. And again, you know, now it's like, okay, I'm living here now. I have more access to the property, which I'd been missing out on for 4 years. You know, I missed that property terribly. I missed my family too, but I missed that property terribly. And, you know, I was like, well, I need to start making this better. You know, I have almost unlimited access to it now with my days off, and, you know, I'm getting paid decent money. I can put money into this. you know, and you know, started thinking the food plot route. We have plenty of open fields that my grandfather mows. We joke that we hunt on our golf course. He keeps the road mowed, you know, he keeps the backfield nice and mowed. The deer will come out and feed in it, but I'm like, I can do more, you know? So we got a little nutty with the food plots this year and put in a handful of, you know, what most people would consider micro-sized plots and put cell cameras on them and such. And I started running conventional cameras in July, or it was probably the later part of June when I started noticing deer, you know, on the side of the road and stuff with, you know, starting antlers. Yeah. I started hanging cameras, you know, just regular SD card cameras. And it was the weekend. It would have been second to last weekend in July, I believe. I went out to spray and kill off where I wanted to put these food plots.
Yep.
Because I was going to try to till and plant August 1st or thereabouts. And so I go out to spray and I check, and I had checked a couple cameras and there was a couple decent bucks. You tell they were going to be decent 8 points. Actually one of the deer that we'd had on the camera the previous year, and I'd picked up his shed, actually both sets of sheds, the previous winter, tight rack 8 point, you know, he's only about yay wide, but he's got these mega brow tines on him. He just looked ridiculous, you know, but we called him the tight rack 8 point. I had him show back up. And so I was getting confident, and I checked one of the last cameras, which I knew I wanted to put a stand in that corner where I was going to put this food plot due to the fact, you know, the way the terrain works, specifically that there's some thick, nasty bedding back in there that I know nobody really goes into, and was hoping that, you know, if the does come out and feed in this field, like I usually see them doing, you know, hold them in there with the you know, with a food plot, and, you know, during that magical time of year, they'll probably going to get checked by a buck. And if I'm in this tree, yeah, you know, it's just a mega, you know, I can't even reach around this tree. It's almost too big to saddle hunt out of. But I knew that if I had it set up and preset, that I could hide behind that tree and not have to worry about getting picked by does and hopefully make a shot on a buck if one presented itself. And I checked the camera at the corner of that food plot. Mind you, we hadn't planted anything yet. And I had a what I would consider to be a mega giant. One series of pictures of him, you could tell he had five tines, you know, started along the main beam, you know, looked to be, you know, as wide as a Buick. And we do not get pictures of deer of that caliber on the farm frequently at all, you know.
Yeah.
And I got a little excited, you know, showing everybody, you know, I showed my grandpa who owns the property, and he was just absolutely floored. I mean, we just don't see deer that caliber very frequently, but there was always the thing in the back of my mind saying, you know, you'll never see him again. He'll be gone. You know, he was just passing through, you know? So we put the food plots in there the first week of August. And actually between that, in June, you know, we went down to Mississippi, Summer's family's from Arkansas, and, we got married on their lake property over in Mississippi. And so, like I mentioned to you earlier, when we took our honeymoon, we went to Springfield. Actually, we took the honeymoon in Branson, made a trip to Springfield to the Bass Pro, and they have that big clearance center, you know, on the side of it. Well, Summer and I were both bargain shoppers. She's a shopper, period. I prefer the term bargain shopper for me. And we're walking around through there, and you know, I didn't really see anything I had to have, but I turned a corner, and they had a rack of scent lock. And with watching the hunting public and learning the saddle thing, and of course watching the tethered guys and their YouTube channel, the name John Eberhardt was constantly popping up. And so I was watching his stuff too. And, you know, what he was saying, especially about saddle hunting, made a lot of sense. And of course, anybody who watches John Eberhardt knows that he has a religious scent control regimen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was always scent conscious is what I would call it. You know, I was washing my clothes in scent-free detergent. You know, I keep them in a scent-free tote. But I was just hunting in mossy oak, you know, regular clothes. I wasn't doing anything crazy. Mostly because, you know, when I'm hearing this guy talk about scent lock, how good could it be? And then you look at the prices online, it's like, I'm not
Better
paying
be
that.
good.
Forget it. You know, forget it. I'm not paying that much money. So I was always scent conscious. I'd take a shower beforehand. I was using ozone generators in my truck to, you know, all that good stuff. And so I saw the scent lock and I was looking at the prices. I'm like, that's actually not too bad. I'm like, I might as well try. So I picked up a scent, you know, a set of scent lock, and you know, got it for a steal and figured, well, we'll give it a shot. And so I started watching some of John's videos specifically about care for scent lock and why scent lock's the best thing since sliced bread and everything. And that's when I got a little nutty and started hunting the, you know, shopping the deals on the website. And of course, I found out they offer a military discount. So, you know, started building my complement of scent lock and going into archery season, you know, that's all I was wearing, scent lock. And just about short of having a minivan, just about following John's scent regiment to a T, you know.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we get these food plots in August, and sure enough, this deer keeps showing up, and now he's put on some inches, and he just looks huge. I'm looking at this deer, and again, I mentioned I'm not good at judging him on the hoof, but I'm like, this deer has to be 140 inches. And but again, I'm thinking there's no way he's gonna stay. You know, he's gonna show up, and then he's gone. You know, that's it. And he had a fork coming off of his main beam on the one side. The two, it would have been his G2 and G3. I'm sorry, G3 and G4 were coming off essentially the same base off the main beam. It almost looked like a mule deer tongue, if you will. And so when we're talking about these deer, I don't name deer. And let me just preface it with that. I don't name them after quarterbacks or nothing like that. You have the tight rack 8, or you have the short time 10, you know, things like that. That's what we use to identify deer when I'm talking to my brother or whatever else, you know. And but I just kept saying, you know, that mule deer looking buck, you know. And so the nickname that ended up sticking, and I'm slightly ashamed to say, was Mule. I don't know why, it stuck, you know. And we dubbed this deer Muley, you know, because A, his body looked like a mule, and he had this that tine. It just made him look like a mule deer, not to mention the rack to make him look like a mule deer. And so he was there till probably middle of September, you know, without looking at the exact date. And I'd get pictures of him, and he was getting bigger and bigger. And then one day, just poof, gone. And you know, I figured, okay, you know, they're shedding their velvet. You know, he moved to his fall range. You know, it was nice getting pictures of him, but you know, never gonna see him. You know, and so I went into archery season. I still had a couple good bucks that I would have been happy to take. You know, and the farm through October just wasn't great. You know, it didn't have a whole lot going on. Nighttime movement for the most part, and I don't typically shoot does the early part of the year. Excuse me, with my bow. I need to, and maybe one day I'll start doing that a little bit more. But I started hunting some public land out here, you know, where I live, you know, about an hour west, and had some encounters with some good deer. Actually screwed up on a nice, real tight rack 10 point with, you know, huge main beams. He was real narrow. He had nice long tines, and I screwed up on him. And you know, he didn't bust me. I missed him, is what it was. But you know, the whole time, again, I've got this fairly refined mobile hunting setup. You know, I'm walking a mile back into the public land, and it was actually a similar area to where I shot a turkey back in the spring. I went, I bet you this is good for deer too. And so I started hunting back there a little bit. But you know, I'm having to carry this gear all the way back in. I'm carrying four Hawk Helium sticks that I had modified. I'm, you know, of course, my platform, little fanny pack with some stuff in it. And you know, my bow. And again, everything is kept in scent-free totes, and you know, the stuff that's not scent locks getting crushed by an ozone generator, and you know, the scent locks, you know, getting deabsorbed, kept in scent free tote. So I figured out the scent free stuff, and I had not gotten busted by a deer at all up to that point. Usually you'd have that one mature doe that busted or whatever. And I didn't have any kind of issue with that. And so fast forward, I took off the whole first week of November. I put in vacation. You know, I think my vacation day started November 2nd, I believe it was, which I think was a Monday this year. And, or I'm sorry, no, it started November 1st. The first day I was able to hunt was November 2nd. And I go out to the farm that opening morning of hunting, and I climb up in the tree, and I'm sitting there, and from back in the thick bedding, I hear the deep throaty grunt, and I'm like,
is there a greater feeling in the world than that? Like the moment,
when it's a nice cold November morning,
oh, man.
And you've got the whole week to hunt on your favorite property, and you're armed to the hilt, ready to go. No, I don't think there is, Dan. Nevertheless, you know, I hear this grunt, and I'm like, okay. So I grab my grunt call and I grunt back, and nothing. I don't hear anything. I grunt one more time, and I don't hear anything. About 5 minutes goes by, and I hear another deep throaty grunt, and it reaffirmed the fact that is what I heard. And I'm like, well, that's probably not a year and a half year old buck. That's probably a good buck. So I grunted again. And I didn't hear anything. I'm like, okay, yeah. I'm guilty of it with turkey hunting. I overcall a lot of times. So I'm like, put the grunt call down, one. Like, just give it a minute. And there was a scrape. There was a scrape probably about 30 yards to my 1 o'clock, you know, along the field edge that a little buck had worked right at daylight. Well, 50 yards down that same tree line, all I see is tine step out of the woods. And I saw the little drop point off the main beam, and I'm like, holy crap, it's him. So he looks like he's going to walk right down the field edge to that scrape. Like, you know, I had to pick my jaw up to grab my bow off the bow hook, and I get the bow in the hand, release clipped on, and I'm like, I already ranged it. That scrape's like 32 yards. He stops there, smoked. You know, like I'm already envisioning what position I want him on the wall, you know. And he gets to about 10 yards before the scrape. And again, you hear John Eberhardt talk about this all the time. He gets about 10 yards, what would be downwind of the scrape, and he stops, he puts his nose down, turns, and starts walking through the open field, the open food plot, you know, straight across it at about 40 yards. And I realized that, you know, this is the only chance I'm going to get. He's not going to come closer. So I'm trying to range him, grab the grunt call, and the hand that's holding my bow, of course, is just, you know, going ballistic. I grunt at him. He keeps walking. I grunt at him a little louder. He keeps walking. And, you know, I have a 40-yard pin. I've practiced plenty of 40 yards. I practice all the way out to about 50, you know, but I don't like using it. My bread and butter is 30 in it. That's as far as shooting a deer. But I'm like, you know, this is a big deer. You know, he's in the open. He's fairly calm, but he's walking. And as he's walking, I've got all these limbs in the way because I kept enough limbs for cover, thinking that there's going to be does in the field feeding. And, you know, that, you know, I wanted enough cover so they wouldn't pick me off while they're spending time in the food plot. And I'm like, you know, could thread a shot, but I don't want to. I don't want to risk wounding them. You know, in the back of my mind, I'm going, you have all week to hunt. You'll see him again. Don't worry about it. As he approaches the other end of the food plot and is about to go up into those pine trees, I'm like, well, got to try something. So I snort wheezed at him. I've had deer, you know, turn and walk in on a dime, you know, do a snort wheeze. I'm figuring if he didn't care about the grunt, if I snort wheeze at him, maybe he'll, you know, maybe he'll turn around.
Oh, yeah.
No. He kept walking.
Damn.
And I'm like, oh, man. You know, so of course you have that feeling of just, well, that was your chance. You know, you're never going to see him again. You know, but And the other side of me, it's like the angel and the devil on your shoulder, oh, you did the right thing, you have all week to hunt, there'll be other chances, and you moron, you should have took the chance, you're never gonna see him again. I hunted all the rest of the week and called in a lot of, little nice little spikes and 4 points and everything else, but never anything to shoot. And I had an opportunity at a couple of decent, 15 and 16 inch 8 points, but with him being in the area, I couldn't do it. Didn't want to do it. So that week is over. I just start going back to my work schedule. And I kept getting trail camera pictures of him periodically, and I'm like, okay, he's still around. But he was mostly nighttime. And I think he daylighted one other time that at least I have trail camera pictures of him on, and that was Veterans Day. I was at work, and it was rainy and miserable and big deer moving in the rain. And there he was on one of the food plot cameras in the middle of the day, but I couldn't do anything about it. So, I'd go up and hunt him, whenever I could, on my days off. And the problem with that was, I'm driving over an hour to get, to get up there. And most of the time I'd end up staying the night at my parents' house. It was just easier. I'd get off of work. I'd go up in time to hunt the afternoon. I'd go back to their house, spend the night, eat dinner, and then I'd go out the next morning and hunt, all day, and then I'd come home. That's not real conducive for a marriage, because she was here.
I could see that being an issue.
An hour away, and she, and to get off subject for a minute, and we can kind of pick up where we were with Muley, but, to talk, family and wives, again, she's a big hunter, so she understands to a point, but she's always been very supportive of, me going and hunting. She knows what it means to me. But there's just a certain point that, you have to put your priorities, in line and put your family first. And I'm not always great at that. And she knows that, and I've told her that. I think the reason I found your material and of course wanted to do this is because I see the stuff that you and your wife post, and I just think it's great. I see a lot of Summer and I in that, and the bond you guys have, her hiding your release to keep you from hunting and stuff like that. It's funny because we do stuff like that, and our running joke, her and I, is if she doesn't want me to go, like she actually throws up a little bit of a protest about me going, I kill a deer. It's the funniest thing, where I'm like, I have to be out there, and no, you've been out three times this week. You need to stay home. I want you here with me. And, she'll actually get a little bit angry about it. Those are always the times I shoot a deer.
Yep.
So I always joke with her. I'm like, tell me not to go, She's like, well, I don't want you to go. I want you to stay here with me. I'm like, well, maybe I'll go shoot.
Instead of talk dirty to me, it's like talk angry to me.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And unfortunately how it started happening, a bunch of the deer I listed on the base, she's like, well, what, why would you, go tonight? We could go to dinner or whatever. And I'm like, no, I got to hunt, and she'd get a little angry, and it would make me feel bad, but it always seemed like I'd shoot a deer, whenever we'd have that little tiff before I'd go out the door, So anyway, she's always been great about it. And last year she sacrificed a lot. And this year, same kind of thing. She's sitting here by herself. Now, mind you, I transplanted her from Arkansas to here. She doesn't have any friends or family close by other than my family. And, between work and things, she'll come home from teaching, and she sits here all afternoon if I'm down at the farm trying to hunt. And so it's a balance, and I'm working on that balance, and I definitely have to start working on the balance now, going into this upcoming year. And but nevertheless, it was always a tense kind of conversation when I was like, hey, I'm gonna go after work and go to Dubois and hunt.
Yeah.
She, well, you already went this week, and when are you gonna, because when I'm at work, I'm there the full 48 hours. You know, there's, I don't come home at night. You know, I sleep there and everything. So she's already by herself most of the week as it is, and then, you know, I take that away from her too. So, yeah, she's tough in that regard, and I don't give her enough credit for it. But anyway, you know, I did that all bow season and just couldn't put it together. And so, you know, going into rifle season, you know, he was off the cameras. It wasn't very long after, I think it was somewhere about the 18th and 15th was the last picture I had of this particular deer this year. And there'd be a couple good ones that would pop up every once in a while, but nothing that big. And so going into rifle season, you know, I figured he was gone. I figured, A, somebody killed him. You know, he got educated and left the property, went somewhere else, you know, just locked down the doe, what have you. And in Pennsylvania, you know, if anybody is from Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Michigan or any place like that that listens to this, you know, they all know, like, gun season, all bets are off,
Yep.
you know, because it sounds like World War III, and you know, any one of those gunshots could be the deer you're after. So I don't get very picky in gun season. You know, if it's a good deer, you know, I'm probably going to take it. I kind of had to write him off that, you know, he was probably going to be killed. And I learned to bet on the deer, you know, without jumping ahead. I learned, you know,
Yep.
my
Oh,
lesson for
yeah.
this year was bet on the deer. You know, there's a reason he got that big. And so anyway, opening day, we were all in our own specific stand. My dad was in his stand, you know, I was in my stand, and like you're talking about, everybody has their set locations, and I put Summer in the best stand. And mind you, we had just found out probably 3 or 4 days prior that we were pregnant. So
Nice.
you know, we were, you know, already excited, you know, and that opening day is Christmas morning for me, you know. And about 7:15 or so, she shoots at a buck, and you know, turned out to be a real nice 8 point, you know, and a deer I'd had trail camera pictures of. And so we recover it and, you know, celebrate it. And all through the rest of rifle season, cameras were pretty quiet, you know, small bucks here and there, and of course does, and we'd see some deer, but they when the shooting starts, they know it's time to run and hide and stay in the
Yep.
thick stuff. Unless they're pushed, they're not going to move. And you know, but nevertheless, I'm sitting in the stand, you know, as much as I can. Her deer ended up being hit by an archer back. Well, I had pictures of him on the 15th of November, and there was no wound on him, so it must have been after that. He had been hit straight down through the back, and it came out the base of his neck, but it stayed
Dang.
above the vitals. Went It almost looked like the person was level with him, and the only thing I could figure is it was with a crossbow,
Okay.
because you know, it with a regular arrow, I think the velocity would have been too less. The arrow probably would have stuck in him.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, it wasn't quite gangrenous, but there was definitely a lot of infection. So we lost the entire neck. We lost both back straps. And conveniently, when she shot him, she took out both front shoulders. So, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to salvage there. So we literally had the hind quarter and, you know, some whatever else we could scrap out of it.
Yeah.
And our freezer was full. You know, we eat about four deer a year ourselves. And, you know, various ways, whether I do snack tips, jerky, plus steaks and roasts and things like that. And so I'm like, we need meat in the freezer. So the way my work schedule fell is I was off Wednesday, Thursday, and then the Friday, Saturday was the closer of rifle season, but I had to work Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I'm like, well, it's going to be, you know, just this Wednesday, Thursday is all I'm going to be able to do. And so I told my dad, I said, well, I said, I'm meat hunting. you know, we're going to go out Wednesday afternoon. Because by the time I get off work and got up there, Wednesday afternoon, if I get a good shot at a doe, I'm going to take it. And he was in his stand. My grandpa was in his stand and I was in mine. And wouldn't you know it, which from all those stands, we have a pretty good vantage of the entire property.
Yeah.
You know, it's 50 acres, but it hunts a lot smaller than that, just the way that the valley is and everything. We didn't see a single deer from the hours of about 1 o'clock in the afternoon till dark, you know, 5:30, which for our place is extremely, extremely rare. Like, you better call a priest because something's wrong. you always see deer on our piece, you know, at least does, you know, and there's a reason I don't kill those with a high powered rifle is because it would be trivial out of our place. We're just fortunate in that aspect. So I've only ever killed one doe with a high powered rifle up until that point. And that was down in Louisiana whenever I was down there. So, you know, after dark, you know, both my grandpa and my dad, that's crazy. We didn't even see a single deer, you know?
Yeah.
So, but we had plans. We're going to hunt Thursday. So Thursday morning comes around, we're all in the stands, and I had some does come out way back the Gaswell Road that I could see from my stand, but they're like 300 yards. I'm like, I don't want to shoot that far. You know, too much can go wrong. And I'm like, you know, we've got all day. We'll see what happens. Well, my grandpa comes out after his doctor's appointment and says, you know, well, I'm going to go for a walk. You know, okay. So that was about noon. You know, we ate lunch, and then he said, I'm going to go for a walk. And he goes out around the hillside. And from the shack that I'm in, I can see up over the other side. And I can see some deer over there. And so I sent him a text. I said, you know, there's deer over there. I said, you know, let's see which way you kick them. So most of them went running up the hill. But I thought I saw one cut down into the bottom. You know, and these deer are 400 some odd yards away from me whenever I'm looking at them.
Yeah.
And about 15 minutes later, doe pops out in one of my right of ways at about 60 yards and kind of trotting across. So I stopped her and settled the reticle. I figured, well, this is my chance. You know, I knew it wasn't a fawn, so I squeezed off and knew I crushed her. I mean, I watched her shoulders buckle and she was, you know, head down, dogging into the pine trees. I called my dad on the radio. I said, I just shot one. I said, you know, it went your direction. I said, did you see it? He says, no. I said, okay, well then she's probably dead between you and me, you know?
Yeah.
I said, that's good. So I, you know, like I said, I had said that to him on the radio. I texted Summer and said, you know, I got one for the freezer. I texted my grandpa, said, I got one. And, you know, I'm hunting in like an 8x8 shack up on telephone poles. And I walked over to my fanny pack to grab another bullet to top off my magazine, put the bullet in the gun, set the gun down in the corner. Less than probably 3 minutes elapses in that amount of time. And I look down the other right away and out steps Tines, just framed at about 120 yards. And at the way he's walking, and at the speed he's walking, I know that this is going to be a split second thing. And I know that if he keeps walking the direction he's walking, none of us are going to end up seeing him. He's not going to wrap around the hill and come through one of the other right of ways or anything like that. So I literally yelled out the window, and he stopped and he looked up at the stand. And I had to hurry up, grab the gun, get it out the window, zoom in the scope. And the reticle is just doing this all over the deer. And it was actually kind of fitting. He was standing just about where my first buck ever was standing whenever I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, I told, you know, literally said to myself, I said, you know, calm down, you know, take a breath, make the shot. And I had a nagging suspicion based on the frame that I saw step out of the woods that it could have been him.
Yeah.
If not, it was a deer of very comparable size. And I settled the reticle right on his shoulder, squeezed. I watched his shoulders buckle, his tail tuck, head down, dogging it across the right of way into the pine trees on the other side. You know, in a split second, he's out of view. And I had that split second, you know, that split second that we all live for, you know.
Yep.
Holy cow, did that just happen? And I got on the radio. Mind you, I'm a fireman, right? So I spend a lot of time on the radio, doing radio transmissions and everything else. And we always tell everybody, you know, keep your cool on the radio. I lost my cool. Of course, the only person on this channel was my dad, you know. I said, you know, I think I just shot Muley. I said, holy crap. I think I just shot him. And he's like, well, where'd he go? I said, he went down to the bottom. He said, all right, well, you know, let's give it some time. So now I went from, you know, worrying I wasn't going to shoot any deer to shooting two within less than 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I gave it, you know, probably about 30 minutes or so. And, you know, of course I had called Summer. She was teaching. And, you know, she answered because she knew there was a reason I was calling at that time of the day. You know?
Yeah.
Again, this is 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of the day. I can't tell you, and again, Pennsylvania hunters, any gun hunters in big pressured states, stay in your stands during lunchtime.
Yep.
I cannot tell you how many deer I've shot between the hours of 10 and 1. Southern hunters, no, get out of your stands. You only hunt the first 3 hours in the morning and the last 3 hours. Don't sit in your stand all the day. But everybody up here in the gun season states, sit in your stands the middle of the day. Anyway, so I go down and check where he was standing, and I knew he was on the trail right before the high wall that dropped off. And I'm looking, there's no blood or hair. And I'm like, oh, you have that sinking feeling, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, there's no way I missed this deer. No way. I know what I saw through the scope, you know? And so I said to my dad, I said, I got no blood or hair, but I've had deer that, you know, are like that.
Oh, yeah.
I said, I'm going to start sneaking into the pine trees here. And there's some pines with thicker brush. And then there's, you know, an underlayer of goldenrods that makes everything nice and thick in there. I said, you know, I'm going to start sneaking in and looking. I got about 5 feet off of the right of way into the pines, and something caught my eye no more than, you know, 7 or 8 yards in front of me. Through a locust tree and goldenrods, I thought I could just see the outline of a deer laying there. And I pulled up my gun, you know, the scope, and I couldn't see diddly nothing, you know, with three power even.
Yeah.
I backed it all the way down. I'm like, ah. So I put the gun on my shoulder and I reached to grab my binoculars out of my harness. And I said to myself and the big man upstairs, as I was lifting my binoculars up, I said, don't let this be some kind of sick trick where this is a rock or something like that. And I picked up through the bush. I can see it, the deer. I can definitely see it, deer hair, and I can see it was laying there, and it was okay. Well, where's his head at? You know, is it, you know, which way is he facing? Is he still up? You know, does he have his head up? And I could see antler, you know, kind of looked like it was laying on the ground. So I'm like, okay, dead buck laying here. Probably a good one based on what I saw walk out. You know, he's dead. So I, of course, started walking up to him, you know, with caution, and sticking out of the goldenrods on the one side, I see that drop point.
Oh, man.
And I knew it was him. And I didn't pick him up. I didn't do anything. I called my dad on the radio, and I said probably the most, you know, quivering, cracked voice I could. I said, you know, hey, you want to come on down here? And he said, did you get him? I said, you'll see. He says, is it him? And I said, you'll see. And so I walked out of the goldenrods, you know, only a couple feet. You know, he'd only made it 10 yards. You know, I walked out of the goldenrods, you know, which was only a couple feet from where he was laying, to where we have like a road cut. And again, hunt on a golf course. So grandpa's got everything mowed down there, you know. And I get to the cut road, and I just hit my knees, and I, you know, I had a moment, you know, and, you know, definitely not one I'm going to forget, you know, anytime soon. I called my grandpa and I said, hey, go ahead and come on down here. And, so my dad gets down there first. I walked to meet him. You know, he had, of course, couldn't see the deer laying up there in the goldenrod. So I walked to meet him and gave him a big hug. And we had a little, you know, celebratory moment there. know, is one of them things, and not to get too feelsies, but you know, even when I'm in Louisiana, I would always call him after I shot. You know, he was always one of the first calls. Now, you know, in recent years, summer a lot of times is the first call, and she'd be mad at me if she wasn't, but he's one of the first calls, and you know, always has been. And he's been with me for so many of the deer I shot, you know, including my first one. He was right there. So we enjoy that celebration. You know? So anyway, we enjoyed it. And I said, well, I want to wait for Papa to get down here. And I said, I want him to go pick it up. You know, cause my grandpa, I think he's 78 or 79 now. You know, he's the one who owns this property. And I hunted a lot with him growing up. And he takes care of that property in such a way that I knew that, you know, something like this meant a lot to him. So he had just as big of a part in it as I did. I said, I want him to pick it up, you know? And so he finally got down there. It felt like forever. He finally comes sneaking down through the creek bottom, and he comes walking up to me. He says, is it the big one? I said, well, go find out. You know? And so he goes walking over, and he picks, you know, he just kept saying, wow, as he's walking up to the wow, and say, wow, you know? He picks up the one side out of the golden rods, is pulling golden rods off the other side. You know, and then, you know, of course we celebrated with it, but, you know, this here is the side that I saw sticking out of the weeds,
the
little drop point. And, you know, this was the side that got pulled out of the weeds, but,
holy cow.
Yeah. he had broke this brow tine off November 8th. I had a picture of him without it for the first time. Taxidermist is going to rebuild that for me, but anyway, he was definitely nice to finally get my hands on. And this right here, I don't know if it's easy to tell, but in velvet it even was a little bit more profound. They come off almost the same base there, and that's kind of how he got his nickname. And
jeez, what a tank.
But to get my hands on him finally was, you know, it was just, it was surreal, you know?
Yeah.
So, we got him tagged and got him pulled out of the weeds. And then we had to, you know, go walking around the other side of the hill and find the doe, and had completely crushed her too. I made almost identical shots on him, straight through both shoulders, took the top off the heart, you know, nice. Neither one of them made it any further than 10 yards. And called my buddy, you know, Tyler with Kinfolk, and he come out and took a bunch of good pictures for me. And, you know, then it was time to get the work done and get him to the taxidermist and get the doe all, you know, skinned out and ready to go, because I had to be at work the next day.
Yeah.
So, it was an absolute surreal year. I like to think I'm putting things together a little bit, you know, as far as my setup, you know, with mobile hunting and saddle hunting. I don't think there's any better way to archery hunt than to saddle hunt.
Yep.
There's just so many advantages to it. There were so many times this year between the saddle and scent walk that you have, you know, a family group of does, or, you know, even a, you know, small buck just hanging out near you, and you can keep that tree between you and the deer. In addition to the scent walk, and I never had a deer spook at all this year. Damn. And that's probably the first year I can say that, you know, while archery hunting, I never even got winded by, you know, big nanny doe or anything.
Yeah.
So with that, and, you know, of course the cellular cameras helped. I mean, knowing what was going on out there in real time. That's one of those ones that, you know, a lot of guys are kind of against them, you know, you know, oh, it's an unfair advantage, you know, but, you know, for me, that's one of those ones that the tool is almost invaluable for me to be able to keep tabs on that property. Cause the way I look at it is it's an hour and a half trip for me, you know, and if there's nothing going on out there, you know, I don't know if I want to make that trip, but if I'm at work and I'm getting real time notifications of, you know, deer in places and knowing what stand I need to be in, you know, that warrants a trip.
Yep.
So, you know, that's definitely a tool I can't give up on.
I feel like that's the case with a lot of different hunting innovations. Right out of the gate, people have a really hard time with it. And I try to tell people all the time, like the fishing game or the conservation departments, they're gonna make rules and make it illegal to use things that are gonna be detrimental to the deer herd or to whatever, you know, species population you're going after. But at the end of the day, a lot of this stuff comes down to, do you want to use it? Do you find it ethical? Right. Are you okay with it? And it's difficult for me to tell anybody because I don't know their exact situation, what's right and what's wrong. I personally love cell cameras. I hopped on a debate yesterday about the live streaming cameras. Because, you know, like a cell camera, it'll send you a picture. But right. The live streaming cameras where you can actually go and click on it and watch it real time, you know, people have a hard time with that. And I'm like, I don't feel like that's a whole lot different. And it really does, as long as it's legal in your area, it comes down to preference and what you're okay with. I think it's an amazing tool and I will continue to use them. That's one of my favorite things, laying in bed. Like, what am I going to do with the information when a deer comes through at 3 a.m.? Nothing. Mm. But
right.
I like that notification going off on my phone and I sit up and I look at it and I'm like, oh, there's a buck. Sweet. You know, it's just exciting to me.
Yeah. I mean, and for me, my biggest attraction to them is I can take that camera and I can put it deep into thick bedding cover.
Yep.
You know, or in a travel corridor that I don't want to set a foot in and know what's going on. I mean, minus having to change batteries or whatever.
Yeah.
That's less that I have to go in there and less intrusive I have to be. You know, and whatever I can do to not educate those deer, all the better. Yeah. And I still run traditional SD card cameras in a couple places. Most of them are in high traffic areas that we walk, you know, access paths and things like that. You know, yeah, the deer use it. And, you know, yeah, it's good to see what's moving through there. But most of my cameras that I'm running out there are in places that, you know, are advantageous, you know, for keeping an eye on, but not going in there and checking SD card all the time. Because whenever I was running, you know, I think I have like 14 or 15 regular SD card cameras, and I ran those on the base a lot. I was always curious. I'd be sitting in a stand and know that I have a camera, you know, 100 yards down the trailhead, but it's like, oh, I want to go check that camera and see what's on it, but I also don't want to go down there and mess things up. So that's why I love them.
You know,
it's just cutting down that, you know, that interaction and that education for them as much as I can, you know, and it also comes down to, you know, my access pass, you know, if anybody's looking for good education on that, that's where a lot of hunters go wrong, is entrance and exit.
Yep.
Watch some of John Eberhardt's videos. I'm not saying he's the most Hollywood, you know, videographer ever, you know, but he gives you every tool you need as far as, you know, breaking a spot down and knowing how to get in and out undetected.
Yep.
And I started doing that down on the base. And like my first year, I was doing it all wrong. I was coming down a cut wide open path that was walking through half of the bedding. And yeah, I mean, I didn't spook very many deer, but how many deer were laying in it? And as I walked by, they walk right past them, they'd get up and walk the other direction.
Yeah.
You know, you never do know. You know, whereas the route I started going in, I was impacting a whole heck of a lot less deer. You have to, you know, look at your access and, you know, keeping it quiet, keeping yourself out of the vision of deer and in a place that you're not going to be detected scent-wise.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong, scent lock helps me with that because I'm one of those nuts that, you know, I get out of my truck wearing my base layer or whatever layer I'm wearing over top, and I put it on outside of my truck on the opposite side of my exhaust, you know, from a scent-free tote. I wear my gloves and my head cover almost the whole way in, you know, and that's the way I climb the tree too. So scent for me this year, zero concern whatsoever. I never once looked at a spot wind wise and thought, I can't hunt. The wind's bad. Didn't pay it any mind. And that's, I apologize to Johnny Eberhard. That's literally right out of his stuff, you know, and I pay zero attention to wind. Yeah. This year I paid absolute zero attention to wind. I have an email written up to him that I haven't sent yet. And it's got a little article, a little blurb, little, you know, essentially high school essay that I wrote about this year and this deer and how I think scent walk, saddle hunting, you know, access paths, all that stuff helped me. I haven't sent it yet. I don't want to be too much of a fanboy, but it's one of those things where, you know, he has some of the best tools in any young archery hunter, any young deer hunter period that wants to kill more deer, you know, or any guy at all that wants to kill more deer, watch those videos.
And that's the thing. I mean, when you have a goal that you want to accomplish, you have to find those people that have already accomplished that goal and figure out what they did, because, you know, you're going to save yourself a lot of struggle, a lot of learning lessons. You know, you can learn from other people's mistakes and go that route. And so that's awesome, man, that you took a lot of this stuff. I mean, it sounds like your development over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years as a hunter has been pretty insane. You know, having to move multiple times, figuring out new land and the resources that you dove into to help you get it done, obviously have paid off, because you're crushing it, man. And I hope to have my hands around antlers like the one you just showed me.
Well, it looks like you have. I mean, and don't misconstrue it. I mean, you know, this he's PNY, but not by much. You know, and I don't pay too much attention to score. You know, for me, it's not about that. It's about killing the mature deer that I was able to target and harvest. You know, killing that mature 8 point on the base. You know, for me, that was a trophy. He scored diddly squat. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's about killing that mature animal. And it, I mean, you said it, the development, you know, I sickened myself a little bit thinking, you know, about things that I did whenever I was 16 archery hunting. You know, it's like, what were you doing? You know, and I've slowly started putting those pieces together. But, you know, goal wise, I still have a goal of shooting 150 inch deer. That is one of my, you know, life goals.
Yeah.
Is to shoot 150 inch deer. And, you know, it comes short about 15 inches. So I have more work to do. But yeah, it's just one of those ones that, you know, I'm glad that I've learned what I've learned. You know,
yep.
I have a fantasy of thinking that I'm starting to figure things out, probably haven't even scratched the surface. But you know, along with killing 150 inch deer, the other goal is to be able to kill good deer more consistently.
Yep.
You know, and I think I'm on at least a decent track for that, you know. And then I start worrying about, you know, the rest of the family, you know, getting my brother one, getting Summer one, you know, which I don't usually have to help her too much. She does pretty good on her own, you know. And
yeah.
I said, it's just, that's what I do. I either fight fires or I'm hunting.
That's awesome, man. Well, it sounds like you've got a great setup up there. It sounds like you're figuring all this stuff out. And I really appreciate you hopping on and sharing your story, sharing your learning lessons, what you're changing, what you're doing now. It was a great episode, man. And so thanks for hopping on.
No, oh, absolutely. I really appreciate you having me on and letting me ramble on for a little bit. It's nice talking hunting with, you know, somebody new and somebody with a different perspective.
Absolutely, man. And that is going to wrap it up for today's show. Man, talk about passion and excitement and desire to continue to learn and educate yourself about the animals that we chase and about techniques and strategies for doing that. And I mean, it's been working out. Like, success up in Pennsylvania, a monster buck down, and it's so cool to just hear from somebody else's perspective their whole journey chasing after a deer, the hunt start to finish, all of the different opportunities and encounters, and then that camaraderie between the family. It's just a cool deal. I hope that you guys have that type of hunting community around you, or that group of friends or a spouse that you call right away when you shoot a big buck or, you know, have a killer day out on the water, and there's nothing like it. So at this point, I think most seasons are completely wrapped up, or maybe there's another week or so left. I'm not totally sure. Either way, get out there, guys, because there's new opportunities. Even when one season ends, a new season's about to begin. Typically, you know, there's still fishing opportunities. Turkey season isn't that far off. Shed hunting, there's some big bucks in different parts of the country that are already dropping antlers, and I'm sure there's elk and muleys and stuff like that too. But yeah, you know what I always say. Until next time, always choose adventure, and God bless.